Welcome to Worlds Apart. The Prussian general and military theorist Karl von Clausewitz famously said that war is a continuation of politics by other means. My guest today takes that a bit further by suggesting that in this day and age, sanctions too are advancing the cause of war. And in the case of the Ukrainian conflict, we have both. Is it likely to lead to a lasting peace? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Hans Kirchler, president of the International Progress Organization. Dr. Kirchler, it's good to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
Now, let's first deal with von Clausewitz's assertion that war is a continuation of politics by other means. I know that you like this quote. You use it in your writing quite a bit. And as cynical as it may sound in our progressive age, is that still true? Is that still the case, not only in the Ukrainian context, but also broadly around the world?
It is still the case, indeed. But of course, we have to add that war is politics by other means. If other forms of politics have failed, that means in particular if diplomacy has failed. But certainly, whatever may have been said since 1945, since the foundations of the United Nations, the use of force by one state against another state is still a kind of almost regular method of the conduct of international affairs. We are told quite often that this was supposed to have changed with the adoption of the United Nations Charter, but unfortunately, that is not true.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm sorry for interrupting. I just wanted to sort of narrow our attention a little bit to the conflict that the whole world is paying attention to now, and by that I mean, of course, the events in Ukraine. I think it's a very difficult decision for the Russians. We will have to deal with the consequences of it, both moral and economic and political consequences for many years to come. But the question I hear often asked here in Moscow is whether it could have been avoided, whether Russia could have achieved what it deems as its existential goals without the use of military force.
If we look back at how things developed, it could have been avoided if one would have implemented those points that were agreed upon by both sides, by both parties of the conflict during the negotiations in Minsk. And in particular, I mean the very precise agreement on specific measures, on a package of measures in the course of the negotiations that are called Minsk II in the year 2015. And I just would like to, can recall here what I said at this time. I issued a statement in connection with the Minsk negotiations in February 2015, where I outlined the basic principles that were contained anyway in the Minsk agreement, namely the principle of self-rule or local self-determination, which also implies a principle of a kind of federal state structure. And I added to that the policy of permanent neutrality, which anyway was initially when Ukraine was founded and when they agreed on a certain non-nuclear status of the country in the 90s, that was always an idea that shaped somehow the foreign policy of Ukraine. So that should also have been followed up. And if this would have happened, the armed confrontation which is going on right now, and which is very unfortunate. Also, by the way, in terms of international humanitarian law, I want to emphasize that that could and should have been avoided if everybody would have acted in good faith. Unfortunately, I do remember I did raise this issue of autonomy for the eastern provinces with Russian-speaking majority around 2018, in a conversation with the presidential candidate of Ukraine. He was defeated. He was a former minister of defense. I did raise the issue. I asked him frankly, why do you not implement the provision of autonomy in the eastern territories? It had been agreed upon. It is on paper. And by the way, all of this has been ensured, has been confirmed.
But Dr. Kirkler, I think you would agree with me that it was on paper, but from the very beginning, I mean, the next day after those agreements were signed, the Ukrainian side, with the help of their Western partners, essentially suggested that, you know, those agreements were reached under duress. There were sort of a political ploy to win time and to change the situation on the ground, the military situation on the ground, and that they should not have been implemented, that they, in fact, implementation of those agreements and even the acknowledgement, the support of those agreements were akin to the betrayal of Ukraine's national interests. And this is what was transmitted not only in Ukraine, but I think the West largely bought into that narrative too.
There was, of course, and there is a very heated debate in domestic politics in Ukraine about this issue, about the rights of the minorities and the rights of the Russian minority. But anyhow, I would say it was the leadership, the government of Ukraine that agreed to that measure of amending the constitution of Ukraine. And these talks were facilitated by Germany and France. And I do not see how one could say that this all was achieved under duress. What I remember, if I may just get back to that discussion which I had with the former Minister of Defense of Ukraine, when he was a presidential candidate, he came to Vienna and he wanted to explain his positions as part of his candidacy. And his reply when I asked about the autonomy provision was, no, we cannot do that. We can never consider it because this would mean disintegration of Ukraine. But this, if this is the idea from the outside, I do not understand how they could have signed it. And just if I may give one example, we have an experience in Austria how through an autonomy arrangement for a national minority, a crisis between two states and conflict can be avoided, because we had almost the same problem with our German-speaking Tyrolean minority in Italy that was oppressed as a result of fascist policies of Mussolini. He wanted to Italianize the German-speaking Tyroleans, so he banned the German language and so on. And as a result of this, after the Second World War, there was an armed resistance by the Tyroleans in Italy, and the situation, the problem could be solved ultimately by Austria acting as a protecting power for the South Tyroleans and by reaching an agreement at the bilateral level with Italy on full autonomy, a very advanced form of autonomy for the South Tyroleans. And we had almost war. I do remember that. Our military was stationed along the border of Italy in the mountains. After, since they reached that agreement, we are, Austria and Italy, are in good terms.
I think that historical analogy only applies if you believe that both sides want to avoid a war. You said that there was almost a war, but it was avoided because the two sides, I assume, were genuinely interested in finding a solution, a mutually agreeable solution, which I'm not sure is the case in the Ukrainian conflict. Do you actually believe that the Ukrainian side and their partners in the West actually wanted to settle that issue for the best of everybody involved?
This is difficult to answer. officially, the Western side would always have said that they are in favor of full implementation of the Minsk agreement. At least that was my understanding as regards the two co-sponsors of the meeting, Germany and France. They never said that they are not in favor of a full implementation, but they did not follow up vis-a-vis Ukraine on it. That for sure they should have done. And as far as I can see now, the real problem is one of domestic politics in Ukraine as far as the status of the Russian citizens of Ukraine is concerned. Because every politician, also the president who is now in office, as I saw some video documents of conversations he had with the leaders of the, or commanders of the Azov battalion. He did not succeed to convince them that they should keep out of politics. And the problem seems to have been over all those years, if a Ukrainian politician would have been in favor of a correct and full implementation also of these domestic provisions, this would have been exploited by the competitors of the other parties.
It's always a problem. I mean, whenever a politician pursues certain agenda, he always encounters, he or she always encounters difficulty. That's the nature of politics. You are not expected to have a smooth ride, especially when you're when you happen to be a president of a country that is positioned right between two major military adversaries. That requires a certain acumen, and that requires a certain, you know, will, a certain willingness to defend your own nation. When you put it that President Zelensky could not persuade the Azov battalion not to meddle into politics, aren't you being too diplomatic? A typical European, I have to say, because Azov battalion, this not just neo-Nazi, but openly Nazi battalion, is not just involved in politics, it's part and parcel, it's fully incorporated into the Ukrainian state machine. Aren't you being a little bit too diplomatic in describing the facts on the ground?
I know this battalion or this unit or this fighting group is now officially integrated into the Ukrainian army. I think the idea behind was to, so to speak, domesticate that group, not to leave them out so that they could attack whatever the Ukrainian government is doing from outside. Unfortunately, it has not succeeded, this kind of project, as far as I understand, because the ideology of that particular group, this is without any doubt, the ideology is extremely right-wing or fascist or whatever you may call it, and the ideology is in favor of a kind of homogeneous nation state of Ukraine where everybody else, whether Russians or for that matter also, by the way, Hungarians, would have to see himself or herself under this aspect of being culturally or ethnically Ukrainian. That was behind also the banning of the Russian language. And I understand only too well the implications of all of that, because as I said, we had the same problem as far as our, I am from Tyrol myself, as our Tyrolean brothers and sisters in Italy were concerned, who were not allowed to use their own language and who were not even taught the language in the school. This is, in Italy, it was the ideology of fascist ideology of Mussolini. And that's not an ideology for our time where we believe in tolerance and multiculturalism. So there must be a kind of, one must develop a kind of form of coexistence. And in a case such as the Ukraine, a kind of amendment of the constitution in the direction of federalism would be the way out. It does not mean that this would be open the way to disintegration of the country, not at all. And as far as I understand, Russia also interprets itself as a multi-ethnic and multicultural country where there are ethnic communities that have their own rights, and also that have in particular situations, in particular areas, also local self-rule.
Dr. Coughlin, we have to take a short break right now. We will be back to this discussion in just a few minutes. Stay tuned.
Forward to talking to you all.
That technology should work for people.
A robot must obey the orders given it by human beings, except where such orders would conflict with the first law.
Show your identification.
We should be very careful about artificial intelligence.
The point, obviously, is to create trust rather than fear.
I would like to take on various jobs.
I mean, with artificial intelligence, we are summoning the demon.
A robot must protect its own existence, its own existence.
Worlds Apart with Hans Kirkler, president of the International Progress Organization. Dr. Kirkler, before the break, we were discussing various ways of bringing that conflict to an end. One of the things that you mentioned was neutrality. And I'm hearing a lot of Russian analysts these days who say that Russia has a stake, in fact, a strong vested interest in maintaining and protecting Ukraine's sovereignty on one condition. That is, if it signs to authentic military neutrality. Is that something that the West and the Americans in particular could ever seriously commit to? Can they commit to not trying to use Russia's neighborhood for their own geopolitical goal, for as a platform for, you know, injecting their influence in this part of the world?
They can't commit on that on a rational basis, namely on the basis of mutuality. And this is exactly the experience of Austria with its own neutrality after the Second World War, in the period of the Cold War. At that time, Austria was occupied by four allied powers, the victors of the Second World War. And our main interest was to regain our full sovereignty and independence, and certainly to get rid of all these occupying troops. The problem at that time was that the great powers, and particularly the Soviet Union at the time and the United States, were quite suspicious vis-a-vis each other. So the only way out of this impasse was that Austria did declare itself a permanently neutral country. And what is important is permanent, that adjective, not just neutral in a particular constellation or in an opportunistic manner, but as a principle of state, as shaping the identity of the state. And as is now known, as is in the history books, it was our foreign minister, by the way, also from Tyrol, as I mentioned Tyrol earlier, Mr. Gruber, who had the idea that we might sound out at that time with the Soviet Union how they would react if we suggest that we could commit ourselves to a permanent status of neutrality. He asked the Indian Prime Minister Nehru in a confidential meeting in Switzerland in 1953 to find out vis-a-vis the Soviet Union how their reaction would be. Initially, it was a little skeptical, as far as I have seen from the official records on the part of Minister Molotov. But 2 years later, it happened. We agreed, the Austrian delegation agreed on a memorandum on neutrality in the negotiations with Moscow. And initially, the Western powers were rather skeptical, in particular the British and the United States, vis-a-vis neutrality. But ultimately, they understood that this was a rational measure of real politik, because each of the powers could be sure that Austria would not be used as a staging ground for any military attacks by their adversaries.
Well, we do have a positive and inspiring historical example, although it dates back quite some time. In our time, do you think if Ukraine indeed signs up to military neutrality, can it be military neutral and an independent, fully self-sufficient state at the same time pursuing its own self-interested, self-guiding policy in other affairs, but just keeping the military aspect on the neutral ground?
It can be, of course. Military neutrality means not only that there are no foreign troops stationed on the territory of a country, and that that country does not join any military alliance. It also means that such a permanently militarily neutral country is also not taking sides when international armed conflicts occurs. That's how Switzerland, by the way, always has interpreted its neutrality, at least until recently, and how Austria also, unfortunately, I've say until recently, did interpret its neutrality. In my understanding, it makes no sense to declare yourself militarily, permanently neutral if at the same time the country joins in measures, in coercive measures against another country in a situation of armed conflict. I mean, the policy of sanctions.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about that, because you actually wrote that you see sanctions as a continuation of politics by other means. You've also suggested that sanctions aimed at hurting a population at large indiscriminately go against human rights. How did you reach such a conclusion?
It is, I would say, rather easy to provide the argumentation. By the way, I did raise the issue for the first time internationally in 1991 in connection with the sanctions that were imposed even by the United Nations Security Council on Iraq as far as human rights are concerned. If the result of comprehensive economic sanctions is that the population suffers enormously, that, for instance, the health services collapse, and that as a result of this, thousands and thousands of people die, this is a very serious violation of human rights. And I consider human rights as a jus cogens of general international law. And that applies, by the way, also to United Nations sanctions. But of course, as far as unilateral sanctions are concerned, imposed by one country or a group of countries as coercive measures in a confrontation with another country, those are anyway outside the framework of international law, because according to international law, it is only the United Nations Security Council that has the authority to impose sanctions as part of the of coercive measures. The next step of coercive measures, according to the UN Charter, would be the use of force. But if countries use such coercive measures like sanctions at their own initiative, there is no authorization, whatever the situation may be, except it's under the kind of right of self-defense. It would be something else if a country is attacked. If it is attacked, it may react with force, but also it may use other forms of force, including economic coercion.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, it's not only a legal issue, but also a moral issue. And the problem with the current batch of anti-Russian sanctions is that they aim to affect not only the Russians, but they may affect the rest of the world as well. There are many experts who are warning about the specter of mass famine or hunger in northern and western Africa. People around the world are suffering from the increases of gas prices and fuel prices. How do you think the world will react to being subjected to, so essentially carrying the brunt of the American decision? Do you think the other countries would be okay with that, or do you think they will voice some objections regardless of what their stance on Russia's actions are?
I think first, the large majority of countries of the world will anyway not agree with this unilateral sanctions policy, which is being enforced right now by the Western countries. Legally, those countries have no right anyway to oblige other countries, such as, for instance, India or China or Turkey, to go along with those, because these are not sanctions adopted by the United Nations. As far as the people in those countries that impose the sanctions are concerned, I think what has not been thought through by the Western politicians is that what will happen, the reactions that will happen when the people begin to feel the problems themselves. In such a case, this mass hysteria, which we have seen now in some of the Western countries, may quite quickly be questioned, and people may get to disagree with their governments about the wisdom of the sanctions. And you see also concerning the oil and gas, The European countries have made an exception, and they always say, I mean, for me, it's quite ironic. They officially say, even the prime ministers and foreign ministers, sanctions must be structured in such a way that they do not affect us negatively.
This in itself is a rather supremacist, if not fascist statement. If you treat yourself and others as two separate entities, and others may bear the brunt of your decision, but your population should not, you should be somehow isolated from that. Isn't that in and of itself a Nazi philosophy?
It's certainly supremacist. That's what I would say. And it is double standards. By the way, now we have again a season, high season of hypocrisy and double standards concerning international norms. And a government that says we should impose punitive measures in such a way that only the other side is hurt, and that our people do not, so to speak, do not have to make any sacrifices. Only the other side has to make a sacrifice, and we have to push the other side into a certain direction through a kind of collective punishment, because that is what what sanctions on this large scale are. And in that regard, sanctions are immoral and are against human rights. One may act if one has disagreements, or if there is an armed confrontation or a war, as we see now. The governments may act against the government of the other country, the policies of which they oppose. But to take the entire people of that other country hostage by forms of sanctions, by the way, also in the field of culture, what does classical music or literature or sports have to do with all of that? That, of course, is collective punishment. And that is a violation of human rights, and that certainly is a violation of most basic legal principles.
Dr. Kochler, we have to leave it there. Thank you very much for this conversation.
You're welcome.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again next week on Worlds Apart.